and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. On today's episode, I'm joined by Yotam Ottolenghi, the Jerusalem-born, London-based, world-renowned chef, restaurateur, and best-selling cookbook author. Yotam had always been expected to follow his parents into the world of academia, and it wasn't until he turned 30 that he decided to follow his true passion for food, enrolling in the prestigious Cordon Bleu Culinary School in London. From there, he became a pastry chef in some of London's top restaurants before meeting Sami Tamimi, a Palestinian chef who became his business partner. They created a small deli in Notting Hill called Ottolenghi, and the rest, you could say, was history. Yotam's signature mix of Middle Eastern and Mediterranean flavors, showcasing mainly vegetables, soon became a sensation, sparking what can only be described as a culinary movement where plates were now about sharing, and the popularity of ingredients like pomegranate seeds, sumac, and tahini in British supermarkets was dubbed the Ottolenghi effect. Now he's the owner of 6 delis and restaurants, a Guardian columnist, TV presenter, and he's back with his 8th cookbook, Flavour. As you'll hear in this episode, Yotam won't visit a destination unless it has great food. And his food is continuously inspired by his extensive global travels. They just feed each other. And so his travel diaries are also food memory diaries, and they're sure to make your mouth water. So from Israel and Bali to Greece and Mexico, here are the travel diaries of a culinary legend, Yotam Ottolenghi. Yotam Ottolenghi, welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thank you so much for coming on today. How are you?
I'm feeling good, and I'd like to say thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, it's so much my pleasure. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast. I'm a huge fan of your recipes. Whenever I go to a dinner and they say that they're doing an Ottolenghi style spread, I'm always like, yes, that's my favorite. And I feel like an appreciation of travel is just so imbued in your food.
Yeah, so I have this kind of, little motto saying, you know, I would never travel anywhere that doesn't have good food. That's the number one requirement, because I try to draw inspiration from wherever I go. So every meal is a potential recipe. I'm just like I'm a recipe hoarder. So that's why in pre-COVID days where I could travel as much as I wanted to, I used to keep a little notebook in which I write what I have, and that becomes a blueprint for a recipe or an idea for a recipe.
Mm. And so your mother is German and your father is Italian, and you grew up in Israel, in Jerusalem. So, a real cultural mix. Did you feel like you had an international identity kind of from the very beginning?
No, because Israel has, especially when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, was full of immigrants. So everybody had in the Jewish community, I'm not talking about the Muslim community, but in the Jewish community, everyone was first or second generation immigrants, almost everyone. Mm-hmm. So it didn't feel so unusual to have a mixed cultural background. In that respect, and that's very much the picture of the city. You've got the old Palestinian population that has been there for a very long time, and then you've got more recent Jewish immigrants that have populated the city in the 19th and 20th centuries. Sorry, in the 20th and 20 and 21st centuries, that's really the situation. It's a city of immigrants, so there's so many cultural experiences. It's unbelievable. And I feel that I've really benefited from having a solid European background at home. You know, like my mom's cooking has always been very much inspired by European, traditional European, Central European cooking, although she's super adventurous and cooks everything. And my father is pure there's this kind of purist Northern Italian approach, really good ingredients, not too messed up with, not mixing up big flavors, kind of almost the opposite to the way I cook. And then there was the, you know, everything outside, which was all these Jewish immigrants from all over the world. And then the Palestinian food, which is still food that I probably like the most, which is that what was served in restaurants and markets in Jerusalem when I was growing up.
So how would you characterize Palestinian food, would you say?
Well, it's a really complicated thing. So Sami Tamimi, who is one of my business partners, and Tara Wigley, who is another colleague of mine, have written a book called Palestine recently, which is all about Palestinian food. And the complexity of this food is comes through every page in the book. As a kind of, you know, people would recognize many dishes from the being familiar with Lebanese food in Lebanese restaurants in the UK, we, you know, falafels and hummus and baba ganoush. But this is just the surface. It's a much more complex and regionally divided cuisine that depends whether you go to the West Bank or whether, or even which part of West Bank, to Gaza, to Galilee, to different parts of the country and where Palestinian mm-hmm. people live, and you really get really incredible things. A traditional dish is called makluba, which is a cake, a savory cake made of a layer of vegetables and chicken and then rice, which you tip over when it's ready, which is a really wonderful mm-hmm. Palestinian classic. It's a typical kind of celebration dish, but all sorts of things with pastries, with bulgur wheat, slow cooked and shortly cooked salads. And it's a very, very interesting, complex cuisine, and I've learned to love it as I was growing up.
And did that feature as some of your key early culinary memories?
Yes, because we used to travel. So Jerusalem was a much more peaceful place when I was younger. And when I was young, the Intifada, which was the first Palestinian uprising, only happened in the early 80s. So up until that point, there was much less conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, at least on the surface. And there was a lot of bubbling tension, but you could really feel that there was a kind of a very short period where things were actually relatively stable. And so we used to travel a lot to go and eat in restaurants all over the West Bank, in Nablus or in Jericho or in Hebron, in different places, Ramallah, Bethlehem. And I really did get exposed to those foods quite early on. We used to sit at the table, and a typical, very generous Palestinian mezes would arrive with fried cauliflowers and all sorts of interesting pickles. And then, one version of an aubergine salad, like what we call baba ganoush, but there's a whole range of variations, and really good tahini and labneh, and then after that grilled meat. So and slow cooked pulses like grains and lentils. I mean, it was really
very hungry.
Yeah, it makes me hungry just to talk about
So let's begin with the first chapter of your travel diaries. Yeah. That's chapter one, which is your earliest childhood travel memory.
Yeah, actually, I was thinking about that. When I was really young, we used to go and spend time on the beach in the Sinai Desert. Again, quite a lot about the politics and the geographics of the Middle East come in this conversation. But Sinai, the desert, was a massive piece of land that was taken over by Israel during the 1967 war between Israel and Egypt. And in 1978, there was a peace accord between Israel and Egypt, and Sinai was gradually returned back to Egyptian control, and now it's completely Egyptian. But during the 70s and early 80s, it was still under Israeli control. So you could just drive down to Sinai, and it was a very virginal, deserty landscape, beautiful colors of red rocks and hardly any vegetation, and the Red Sea was just super beautiful, and you could stop on a number of stops along the way on the Red Sea to camp. And there was Bedouins who were normally running these sites where you could stop and pitch a tent, and you could get a meal from the local Bedouin population. They would run like kind of semi-restaurants. And it was very, very, very basic. You know, the Red Sea with its incredible population of fish, and there's a wonderful reef all along the Red Sea with aqua life.
One of the best places in the world to snorkel and to dive, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
And we did a lot of snorkeling. Really, there's incredible, incredible, incredible fish and algae, and it's just fantastic. So we used to go there, spend a few days on the beach in a tent, just enjoying the sun, walks in the desert, and the Dead Sea. It was the Red Sea was truly remarkable.
Oh, that sounds glorious. And did you have a love of food from a young age, or did that come later, would you say?
Love of food I've had from a young age, definitely. I've been considered quite a greedy little boy when I was growing up in the best possible way with my family, because I always wanted to go and, you know, have something to eat, and but not in a kind of a run-of-the-mill kind of place. I was quite drawn to different kinds of food. So whenever we traveled, I was the first to try to explore the different foods that were available. And I had this obsession with fish and seafood, which were not the first thing you would get in Jerusalem. But whenever we traveled, I would always try and get some seafood. And so prawns or shellfish in general.
Because they're not kosher, right?
They're not kosher, no.
So they would be hard for you to get when you were living in the city.
Yeah, it was hard to get. There was one restaurant in East Jerusalem that would serve them, and it was kind of like a birthday treat to go and eat there. They had these amazing prawns, very simply prepared with garlic and butter and lemon juice, and I will never forget that as a kind of a seminal experience. Whenever it was possible, I'd get my parents to take me there. And then if we went abroad, then as well, I would always try to. So I was a very keen eater. I wasn't one of those kids that were really naturally drawn to the kitchen. That came later. I did experiment a little bit with cooking when I was younger, but it was mostly I'd let my mum and dad cook for me. And then when I went to university in my early 20s, that's when I realized that nobody would cook for me anymore. So I had to, fend for myself. And that's when I really got seriously into cooking.
And some people who don't know your background might think that you might assume that you went to university to study cooking, but actually you didn't. You were set to go down a different path originally.
Yes, I went to university to a more, traditional, I want to say, but more traditional in my family. So yeah, I studied humanities, literature and philosophy. And I spent quite a few years in university being very serious about these subjects. I really enjoyed them and I was good at them. I finished my master's degree and I was not quite sure what I was going to do next. And although I did enjoy, you know, the subjects, I found academia quite insular. I always have this memory of finishing my dissertation for my master's degree, which was on some kind of obscure subject about representation in arts. And I handed my supervisor the final draft of my dissertation. And I printed a few more copies. You know, I was quite proud of it. It was a long, you know, I worked on it for quite a long time and gave a few to my families and friends, etc. And to this day, I doubt anyone read it apart from my supervisor. You know, it's so niche and so obscure. And I think this kind of encapsulates my university experience. It was really interesting, but it didn't really resonate with anyone apart from probably myself and a couple of other people who sat discussing these topics at the university cafeteria. So I think I needed a wider audience and I wanted to be engaged in a conversation with more than just myself and a couple of other people. And food, I felt, is that kind of place. So I've enjoyed cooking and then I enjoyed cooking for people and getting their feedbacks. And
food is such a way of connecting with people.
Yeah, and the feedback is immediately, again, as opposed to university where everything takes so long and the protracted processes. Like when you cook a good meal to a group of friends, you've got this kind of immediate gratification with, you know, happy faces, the oohs and the ahs, and it's just that kind of thing. So I think that really kept me going and made me consider, okay, that might be a career, even though I did embark on it quite tentatively. I wasn't quite sure if this is going to be my life's choice career, but I've come to London and I took a cookery course, and then I started working in restaurants. And although it was really, really hard because I was kind of a late bloomer and I wasn't really kind of a typical chef that started cooking at the age of 17, I really enjoyed that kind of sense of joy and recognition and being able to get that kind of sense of the appreciation that I haven't received before.
Mm. So let's pause there and move on to chapter two of your travel diaries. And that is the first place that you fell in love with. Where would that be?
We used to go to Florence a lot when I was a child, because my father was born in Florence. They had to leave Europe before the Second World War. So they left Italy when he was a very young child. But during my childhood, so in the 50s and 60s, before I was born, my father and his parents kept on going to Italy. And there was a small apartment in Florence that belonged to the family that they kept. And we used to go and stay in that apartment in the summers sometimes when I was a child. And this was an ongoing thing. I think we've been there a few times, maybe from the age of 6 or 7 and then on to my teens. And those visits to Florence really stuck to my mind. I really did fall in love with this place, with how different it was from where we were growing up, that kind of messiness of Jerusalem and Florence with its history, but also very kind of solid European and Northern Italian restraint. And I loved the food and I loved the smells. And my dad would go out in the morning and get focaccias from the bakery and all sorts of interesting breads, rolls that were so fresh and delicious. And I've got this rosemary focaccia from the bakery or an schiacciata, which is another kind of flatbread that was topped with grapes and fennel seeds and some sugar. And those were things that really stuck to my mind in terms of flavors, but also the whole business of how different it was, how European and civilized it all seems, you know, the churches and the synagogues and the big squares and the galleries that we used to go and see the old masters' works. And I loved everything about this city. I still do. I haven't been there for a few years, but it just stuck into my mind. I think this is one of the first places that has definitely, the ice cream, the pistachio ice cream. There was one place, gelateria, where we went. It was called Perché No, and we used to go there and get pistachio ice cream and sit. And it's just, you know, it's unforgettable. The most delicious experience.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like Last autumn, when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. If Yotam has inspired you to book your own Mediterranean adventure, the Thinking Traveller should be your first port of call. Founded 18 years ago by husband and wife duo Hugh and Rosella Bogier, their collection of luxury villas across Italy, the Greek islands and Corsica are some of the best properties out there for a villa holiday and come in all sizes, whether you're travelling as a couple or for a big family reunion. Their portfolio is highly curated to ensure both quality and exclusivity. You can't find these villas anywhere else, which makes them all the more special. I'm eyeing up one of their gorgeous waterfront villas in Sicily for a spring break next year. It's Rosella, the co-founder's homeland, and she has expertly selected the best spots on the island to stay, from the sandy beaches on the west coast to the charming town of Termina and the city of Syracuse in the east, one of Simon Calder's hidden gems on his episode last season. What's more, they offer loads of different unique activities that you can easily add on to your trip, from cookery classes to guided local tours and even a helicopter trip over Mount Etna. Their team of local concierges are available during your stay to provide on-the-ground support so you can just relax. Booking a villa is a breeze. You can either call one of their villa specialists who'll help you pick the villa for you, or you can book directly on their website, which is so easy to use and a real source of inspiration and wanderlust. Head over now to thethinkingtraveller.com/travel diaries for a very special extra treat when you book. An in-villa dining experience for you and your group with your very own private chef. How amazing is that? So head over to thethinkingtraveller.com/travel diaries and book your villa today. Now let's get back to Yotam. It seems like all of these different experiences have informed your food philosophy. And having studied philosophy at university, what would you say your food philosophy is?
It's complex. One? I mean, for me, it's. I always like to say I don't like processed food, and I think when I say that, of course, I don't like processed food that you buy in a supermarket, because I think it's always better to cook yourself. Although I've done that many times myself, but what I mean is things that have been messed about with too much, and so I kind of position myself a little bit on the opposite camp of very elaborate cuisines of the kind of French tradition. That so for me, I prefer food that has its origins in the home and is very doable. And when you smell something, you know exactly what it is, and it's connected to home cooking. My recipes have not always been simple. I mean, people have accused me, and probably sometimes rightly so, by cooking complicated things. But that complication probably came from a long list of ingredients and not from techniques that were complicated. Mm-hmm. For me, mm-hmm. it's food that really screams flavor and that is very approachable. You know, that's something that you know and you want to eat again. And it's not like kind of things that are processed and chopped up and passed through sieves a million times until you really don't know what they are and what they mean. I went to the Cordon Bleu cookery school when I was coming to London. I learned a lot. I really did learn a lot about the basics. But one of the things that I learned that I don't want to do is turn vegetables, you know, to take something that looks like one thing and turning it to turn it into something completely different for no apparent reason, just mm-hmm. because you want to kind mm-hmm. of control it, if you see what I mean. So dicing a potato to perfect sizes, or turning a potato so they all look the same, doesn't make sense to me. I feel there's much more merit to keeping things closer to the way they should be. And so a round vegetable stays round, or at least wedges in my kitchen, rather than being perfectly diced.
Yeah. And the popularity of your food and your way of cooking and recipes has really redefined a way of eating, and some might say even transcended beyond that. Like, I remember when Theresa May was the Prime Minister, and she said in an interview that she preferred your recipes to Delia Smith, and that was big news. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I looked that up today, and the first article that comes up, it's a Spectator article, and it has a headline, "Theresa May's Ottolenghi revelation is gobsmacking." And it goes on to say that this is as clear an indicator as you can get that you're a cosmopolitan internationalist with a free and easy approach to immigration. Your TAM is not just a source of really good recipes, but an indicator of an entire socio-political outlook. So do you agree with that?
I don't think I can disagree. I wouldn't necessarily want to be seen as you know, necessarily like that. I mean, I don't want to be judged by the crowd of people who are, you know, the stereotypical crowd of people who follow me, because I think it kind of reduces the endeavor a little bit. I mean, it what I try to do is cook really delicious food and present it to the world with the related stories that come with it. And I'm a huge collaborator. Like, every book that I bring out is a collaboration with someone. Well, most of the books. And telling that person's story, or telling particular stories of cultures and people that I meet, is kind of my mission. But I'm also aware that I've been adopted by, but that kind of cosmopolitan group of people who travel the world and see, and I myself am one of them, because I do travel a lot, and I do draw my inspiration from all over. So I should feel flattered by the idea that people, that it resonates, and for whatever reason. And if Theresa May likes to cook my food, I'm very happy about that. That's a compliment.
Yeah. So moving on to chapter 3, that is a place where you learned the most about yourself. Where would that be?
Yeah, so that was Amsterdam. After mm-hmm. I left Israel and before I moved to London, I spent 2 years in Amsterdam. And I went there for no really good reason. I mean, it's a great city, and I still love it to this day. But it was a kind of a mid period in my life where I was not quite sure where I was heading. I went there with my boyfriend at the time, Noam. We went there to just kind of live somewhere else for a little while. And I finished my dissertation remotely for my university degree in Tel Aviv, went out clubbing a lot, and really didn't really know where I was heading. It was a kind of existential crisis moment in my life. And this is where I also started being a little bit more serious about food and cooking. So I went to the markets and the supermarkets and bought ingredients and tried to play with them a bit more systematically. I ordered from Books for Cooks in London, Julia Child's book about French cooking, which is really the very basic script manuscript for cooking. And I thought, okay, well, I'm not sure I'm going to be an academic or a journalist, which were the assumptions that I've had for a very long time. I'm not sure that this doing nothing is good for me, you know, going out clubbing every night either. And I need to sort of find myself. And I did it. And I started to cook and really experiment and read, you know, kind of educate myself more about cooking. It was a really useful waste of two years, because I found out that I should try this. I should really try that. And those were, so that was a very particular time. And Dutch culture is not particularly famous for its culinary achievements, but there were really good ingredients there, fish, and cabbages and root vegetables that I could play with there. And I learned a little bit about Indonesian food, which has a connection to Holland. And so it was a very, very useful time for me to learn something, even though it seemed a bit pointless and aimless at much of it.
And it changed your course eventually.
It did. And it's also a beautiful place. And there's something very open and very liberal and very hospitable about Dutch culture. And I think it does give you space to kind of do things for yourself. And Amsterdam is such a wonderfully beautiful, civilized place. So you can just feel free to do things. And I did.
It's one of my favorite cities. You mentioned the Indonesian cuisine. If you visit, you must go for an Indonesian meal, wouldn't you say?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I would say that, but I'm not so sure I can stand behind that, because your next question to me, I'll tell you what it is already.
Yeah,
it is about my all-time favorite destination, city, and hotel, and that really connects nicely to the Amsterdam experience. So the only time I had Indonesian food was in Amsterdam. Well, I've had it in other places, but the first time I encountered it seriously was in Amsterdam. And I guess what you have in a similar way that you have kind of Indian food in Britain is the kind of post-colonial remnants of that history in food through immigrants and through the local tastes. And it's a kind of a slightly different variation on that theme. So a Dutch Indonesian meal is not an Indonesian meal, if you see what I mean. In the same way that you find in the UK, Indian meals are not authentically Indian. And I'm not going to cast judgment whether that's a good or a bad thing. I think it's just the way it is. And you get some versions are great, some versions might not be that great. But last year I went to Bali with my family for a literary festival that I was invited to. And I had some Balinese and Indonesian food in situ, and it was a revelation, in the sense that I could see, okay, well, I had some good Indonesian food before. I'm not undermining it, but it's never the same as in the real place, and because you don't get the intricate differences between the variations, the tiny little details. You just don't get those when you have it outside the country. And that's true about every cuisine in every place. So traveling in Bali and trying those rice combinations, you know, where you have rice at the center of a plate and condiments, sambals all around, and cucumbers and salads and fish and things that are, and chili and peanut sauces and things that are kind of related and have to do with it, but you know, come together so nicely when you have the whole thing in one sitting. Really came to life for me. So I traveled to Ubud for the festival and got to stay at this incredible hotel that they put us up, my husband Carl and our two boys. It's called the Royal Peter Maha, which is a real old school hotel. It's not the Four Seasons. It's beautiful and luxurious, but in an old school kind of way. I don't think it was renovated yesterday. I was spoiled rotten there. First of all, you know, the room with the pool, and all the pools in the hotel were stunning. It's like, I think I always say to people that Ubud or Bali in general is like the land of swimming pools. Wherever you go, there's a more beautiful swimming pool than the one you swam with earlier. And there was
and so photogenic.
Yeah, holy spring water pool in the hotel, and that, which is literally in the rocks, you know, you swim totally in the jungle. And then there was a lagoon pool which was slightly warmer, but it's all kind of, you know, magazine material that you've never thought you're actually going to experience. And we went with our boys because, you know, we were invited to the festival, and I said to them, you just don't know how spoiled rotten you guys are, because, you know, you're 4 and 7 and you've already been to the most beautiful place in the world. I mean, you're just super lucky. It took me to reach the age of 51 to get there. And here you are. You have no idea how beautiful this is.
You're so well traveled. I was, you know, reading various articles and interviews, and it seems like you really have traveled a huge amount of the globe. So with your young kids, where are you most looking forward to showing them that they've not been yet?
Well, gosh, where I want to take them is to different parts of Asia that I've been to northern India, where I've traveled, to Japan, to Vietnam. I mean, I would love to take them to all these places. I want them to grow up a bit, because I think these experiences are slightly lost at the very early years. Although they had a great time in Bali, I don't know how much of it they're going to actually remember. Yeah. But I really want to take them to all these places that I've been to. But I also want to take them to Mexico, because I've never been to Mexico. And as you call me well-traveled, I don't think I'm really well-traveled until I've visited Mexico, because I've been in the company of so many people who love that country so much and have enjoyed its food to this incredible degree and allowed me to learn how to cook Mexican food to a certain degree. I wouldn't say I'm a good Mexican cook, but I know a few things. So this is what I'd love to explore it with them, because I wouldn't have the prior knowledge. I've never been, so I'd love to kind of learn to know Mexico through my eyes and their eyes as well.
Mm. So where do you always eat well? Where's the destination that you know that you'll always have the most exciting culinary experience?
You know, I've had these experiences in Malaysia and Vietnam, two countries in Southeast Asia that have just kept on giving. You know, wherever, you know, the more I traveled in those countries, and I haven't traveled massively, but I've spent a week here, a week there. There was just incredible foods too. Malaysia really is, I think, one of the most incredible food destination, because it's made out of three main cultures, the Malay, Chinese, and Indian, and all sorts of subcultures as well that are not covered by this generalization. But they come together in such interesting ways. So, you know, you've got Chinese style noodle soups of all kinds, and then you've got the Indian flatbreads, the fried breads that you get, and then Malay intensely spiced curries and of all sorts. And it's just the most incredible country to travel. And I traveled there with Helen Goh, who's a collaborator of mine, and a colleague and a friend, and she took me as someone who grew up in that country and just showed me all the gems. I mean, nasi lemak, which is the traditional Malaysian breakfast, is just such a wonderful. It's a coconut rice. It sounds so simple: coconut rice, a chili sambal, some dried anchovies, and maybe a chicken and some cucumbers and egg. And it's just the most humblest thing. But when you put it all together and have it, it just makes so much sense that you totally fall in love with it.
Mm, sounds absolutely delicious. Part of the world that I've not yet been to. And it just, I think I'd just spend most of my time eating if I was there.
Yeah, I think you join the whole nation, because that nation, they're famous for all they do is eat. You just speak to a Malaysian person, they'll tell you all we do all day is eat. It's not a overstatement. It really is.
Sounds like my kind of country.
Yeah.
So moving on to chapter 5, that's your hidden gem, a much loved spot of yours that maybe our listeners might not know about.
Yes, I've been there once many years ago with Carl. It's an island in Greece called Folegandros. It's a tiny island. I hope I don't spoil the island by spreading the word out. You can ride a scooter from one end of it to the other in about 25 minutes, if I'm not mistaken. It's got one tiny little town that you reach by boat. There's no airstrip. It's hard to get to the beaches. It's a bit of a stretch to walk, or there's little boats that go around the perimeter of the island and take you there. But it's just, you know, it is the typical beautiful Aegean island, and it's whitewashed little houses, tiny little restaurants. Maybe when we were there, I think we only discovered three or four on the whole island. So it's a very, very small place, and it's just spectacularly beautiful. And you know, you go there and you completely join the village life for the duration. You know, people are gathering around the square, having something to eat and drink for a very long time, you know, until the middle of the night. And it's just, but it's small. And that's what I love about it.
That sounds gorgeous. Are you, and you're a big fan of the Greek islands from the sounds of what you've
mentioned. Oh gosh, I love the Greek islands. Even when I was growing up, because it's so close to Israel, we used to go to the Greek islands a lot. And the sea, anyone who likes to swim in the sea, I don't think you can dispute that this is the most beautiful in the place in the world to swim. Yeah. I mean, I haven't been to the Caribbean, and I guess I haven't been everywhere, but from all the places where I've had a swim, the Greek islands are by far the most beautiful and wonderful places to dip your body in.
So many hidden gems. And actually, speaking of hidden gems, your recipe books always showcase lesser known ingredients, those kind of hidden gems, and you always make them shine. So let's talk about flavor. Mm-hmm. I mean, flavor's been such an important part of our conversation so far, and your new book is called Flavor.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about the inspiration behind it.
So I've published two books so far, plenty and plenty more, that focus on vegetables, and I haven't published one for a while. And there's all these things, ideas about vegetable cooking that came out of my test kitchen in Camden in North London and from the restaurants over the last few years. And it just felt like I really need another vegetable book out there, because there's just a lot going on that I haven't really spoken about in a book. And so the idea was to take all the best vegetable dishes that have come out of the test kitchen over the last few years and put them together in a book. And I've collaborated on the book with a chef called Ista Belfridge. And Ista has been working with me in the test kitchen for 4 years, and she's got an incredible heritage herself. She's got a bit of Mexico in her, Brazil, Italy, and she grew up in between Italy and London. And she's really an incredible, talented, inspirational cook. We've put the book together with a lot of her ideas in the center. And so there's quite a lot of Mexican, a lot of chilies, a lot of lime, a bit of Brazil, a little bit of Italy, and quite a lot of Asian ingredients, which she also loves. And and it's all about celebrating vegetables and ramping up their flavor and really bringing them to new heights through charring and browning and all sorts of interesting techniques. So we isolated we broke down the recipes into three main sections. One deals with the processes that happen when you're cooking vegetables, charring, browning, infusing, and aging. The other is about pairing, what you pair your vegetable with in terms of flavors that really brings them out, sweetness, fat, acidity, and chili heat. Those really ramp up the flavor in the vegetables. And the other is about particular produce that really bring out flavor in vegetables, mushrooms, alliums, which are onions and garlics, nuts and seeds, and sugar or sweetness in general. And that is the way we broke down the book. But it's a really traditional Ottolenghi cookbook in the sense that it brings new flavors, flavor bombs, we like to call them, all sorts of interesting concoctions that you can marinate your vegetable with that you can drizzle over. There's and they really, really kind of do all these cultural mixes that I love. There's a dish in the book that I love talking about, which is, we call it the fusion caponata. So we make a caponata, which is a Sicilian dish of aubergines. It's kind of a sweet and sour Italian condiment with aubergines and celery and tomatoes and capers and olives. So it's got sweetness and sour in it, but we actually give it a kind of a slightly Asian twist. So we add some soy, some rice vinegar, and then serve it with silken tofu. You know, on the face of it, it sounds pretty weird, but actually when you think about that, in Italy, you could replace that silken tofu with ricotta, which is another gloriously bland ingredient that soaks flavor so well. It makes total sense. And we do a lot of these things in the book where we kind of take something which maybe intuitively belongs to one culture, but we mix it up with another culture. So like there's a recipe for hummus, and I published many hummus recipes in my lifetime.
Yeah.
But this one has this infusion of lemon, garlic, ginger, and coriander and cinnamon in olive oil. And that becomes the topping for the hummus. Again, something that comes out of my collaboration with Ista, which she loves infusions and she loves those kind of cross-cultural infusions. So, yeah, the book is all about celebrating vegetables or anything that grows, you know, I mean, vegetables and grains. But it's got a very, very loose flexitarian approach. So, you know, we use fish sauce on occasion or anchovies or Parmesan cheese, mm-hmm. which are not vegetarian. But they bring out the flavor in vegetables so well that we are not shy about using them. And obviously when people don't want to use them, it's very easy not to use them in the recipes. We offer alternatives.
Was the kind of environmental aspect a part of your inspiration for bringing out this third book about vegetables? Or was it more just because you love vegetables?
I've always loved vegetables, and I've never preached about vegetables. I always felt that vegetables are so good in their own right. They don't really need anyone to preach. You just need to show people how to cook them creatively and bring out the flavors. But over the last few years, I've become more and more convinced that it's really important for us to focus our diets on eating vegetables, whether you are a vegetarian or a vegan or not. It's really, really important to shift to veggie heavy diet for all sorts of reasons, environmental, animal welfare, and for the sheer, you know, health of eating all those vegetables. So I'm still very much not a preacher. I don't want people to eat something they don't want to eat, but I think they're missing out on something if they're not enjoying the whole array and possibilities that vegetables have going for them. So the book is really about, you know, singing the praise of vegetables and showing there's a recipe. There's three recipes that derive from one head of celeriac that you cook in the oven for literally almost 3 hours until it becomes all brown and caramelized and beautifully, intensely umami flavored. And we take that head of celeriac that spent so long in the oven and create three completely different dishes with it. To kind of give an example of how versatile vegetables are, one of them is inspired by a steak, you know, like a steak you have in a French restaurant, which is, mm-hmm. but it serves with a Café de Paris sauce. So it's a kind of a creamy, tarragon-y, capery kind of sauce that you'd often find over a steak, but you put it over this celeriac that spent all that time in the oven and you really don't miss the meat. Or another one is where we take those celeriac pieces and put them into little shells made out of cabbage and like a taco. Tacos made out of cabbage, and we put barbecue sauce over those pieces of celeriac and some goat cheese and some pickled chili, and that becomes almost like a little celeriac snack.
I really like the look of that. Yeah. That looks so delicious.
So there's really all those things that you can do with vegetables, and the book is just about telling that story and how to ramp up flavor in vegetables and make them even more delicious than they already are.
And it's a really generous book, actually, from my experience of looking through it. And I'm really looking forward to trying some of the recipes, but there are so many there. I do think with some books that they're often fairly limited, but there's just almost a year's worth of cooking that I could get going on in there, which just makes it even more exciting.
I hope so. Yeah, definitely. That was the point. We really wanted to show with it. The thing is, for me, food is all about generosity of spirit. I mean, a book needs to be big and expansive with the flavors, with a number of recipes, with the visuals. It's just always been the case in my worldview that's what cookbooks should do. And that was the point of this one as well.
Fantastic. So let's pause there and return to your travel diaries. Chapter 6 is your worst travel experience.
My worst travel experience. Well, I've only traveled to China once, and it was for a very short visit. I went with a good friend of mine to Vietnam, and we spent a glorious week in Vietnam, really mostly in Hanoi, just sampling all the wonderful things that this place has to offer culturally and food wise. And then the next stop on our trip was the city of Guangzhou in China. Yeah. And I just became terribly sick, like really sick, like I've never been so sick beforehand. And it was it was absolutely awful. My friend was a designer, and he was exhibiting some of his furniture in a big trade show in Guangzhou, and that's why we went there. And we were in this hotel room in Guangzhou at, I don't know, 60th floor. I have no idea, but it was very high up above the clouds, above the smog. And I was sick as a dog. You know, I was just, I had the highest fever, and I just, you know, and I couldn't sleep. And all I did was I had watermelon juice that they brought to the room, because it was the only thing I could bring myself to put in my body. And so 3 or 4 days that were supposed to be about exploring the city and that part of China were completely lost out to me, sitting in a hotel room. So I haven't left the room even once in the whole time that I was there. So that was my Chinese experience.
Well, you need to go back and have a positive one, that's for sure.
Oh, I definitely do, yeah. Travel is fun when you are unburdened, but when you're burdened by something, traveling can become a real pain, because you really want to be home, because that's where you deal best with these things. It's like, I always think about, like, my kids are quite young, but when they were really young, like, you know, toddlers, we tried to go on holiday with them a couple of times, and we still called it a holiday, and that was just a completely misconception, because it's just not a holiday when you travel with toddlers. Now our trips with them look a little bit more like holidays, but they really didn't look like anything like it for many years. And we always said, like, well, actually, we're better being at home with those two than actually traveling, because you know where everything is, and you know what, you know how you should be doing and all the rest. So it took a while before we really started enjoying our holidays with the kids.
So we're on to your final chapter, Yotam. That is chapter 7, and that is, what is the destination that's at the top of your travel bucket list?
Yeah, so I would really love to go to Mexico. I've never been to Mexico. I've almost been to Mexico on a couple of occasions, but it never quite happened. And I feel like I've known a lot about this place just based on dishes that I've eaten. And also connects us back to the book, to flavor, because there's a lot of Mexican-inspired dishes in the book, like tacos, yeah. A couple of desserts, and there is, that's through Ista, my collaborator, who's really loved Mexican food and introduced me to all the wonderful things that you could do with Mexican chilies, dried Mexican chilies, and there is a transformational thing that you can create with chili. And it can also transport you to the country where they come from. And I feel like I've almost been in Mexico through the chilies and through the tacos and all of the Mexican inspired dishes in the book, but I haven't quite been there. So I really want to go and travel throughout the countries and go to the Yucatan and have tamales and just all the things that I've known about and enjoyed so much, but haven't really managed to do yet.
Wonderful. Well, I hope that you make it there when we're able to travel easily again, hopefully not too long.
I know. Well, this is the thing. We haven't been able, as someone who loves traveling so much, I really, really miss being able to travel because it's just such a wonderful experience and has also given me so much of my inspiration, for what I do.
Well, thank you so much for transporting us somewhere far away from our armchairs today. It's been such a pleasure to chat to you. So thank you so much, Yotam. Those were your travel diaries.
Thank you, Holly. It was fun to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. Oh, that was the truly delightful culinary legend that is Yotam Ottolenghi. His new recipe book, Flavor, is out now. I have a copy. I can tell you, not only is it beautiful aesthetically, but it is chock full of incredible recipes. So I can't recommend it enough. Go out and pick up a copy now. If you've enjoyed today's episode, then if you wouldn't mind taking a couple of seconds to leave a quick review or rating on your podcast app of choice, that really helps other people to discover the podcast and in turn helps me to book guests like Yotam. I really appreciate everyone who's left a review so far. Thank you so much for all of your support. And if you'd like to hear who is going to be on next week's episode, the season finale, then head over to my Instagram. It's at Holly Rubenstein, and I would love to hear from you. And for everything else podcast related, visit thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll speak to you next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.